Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Telltale Heart, the Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. We are in for a treat today. I think we're going to do something a little bit different. As you may be aware, this episode is dropping the Tuesday before the American Heart Association meeting that is occurring over the weekend. And as a first look and an early look, we're going to be taking time to go over some of the trials, the late-breaking trials, to kind of get an assessment or opinion of, you know, why these trials are in existence, what it could mean, and get excited about what the data could be, similar to what we did for the European Society of Cardiology meeting. However, we're going to do it a little bit different. We don't have a panel this time, but we have one person. But before we jump into introducing that person and getting into this activity and explaining the rules of the activity, I'm going to just pause again and just remind people, if you like this content or you like what we're doing, please, you know, like or subscribe. If you could go in there and rate the podcast, that would be outstanding, and provide commentary. Please reach out or provide feedback via email or other means. If you have ideas, suggestions, you would eventually like to be on the podcast or screening purposes from that standpoint, just to be aware, the kind of housekeeping is the next several versions of this will include a breakdown or more in-depth analysis once we have results of several of the trials. And then afterwards, we're going to do some work around hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and also around amyloid after AHA coverage ends. So that's kind of the direction of where we're going. However, obviously, if there's other things that come out and interesting stories or things that come to fruition from the meetings from that standpoint. Without much further ado, I'm going to jump straight into this. And so today I have an esteemed colleague and friend and guest, Kyle Fisher, who is on. So Kyle, why don't you tell the audience who you are, where you're from, and what your practice site is?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Craig. So like Craig said, my name is Kyle Fisher. I'm a cardiology clinical pharmacy specialist at Ascension City Medical Center Austin at the University of Texas Austin, here in Austin, Texas. I'm originally from Texas, born in South Padre Island, so that's pretty south, in the Texas state. If, for those who are not familiar with Texas, I went on to go do my pharmacy school at Texas A&M Kingsville, and then did my PGY1 internal medicine pharmacy residency at UT Southwestern, and then went on to do my PGY2 cardiology pharmacy residency at Duke, and now back in Texas practicing. So I'm excited to be on the pod and looking forward to this discussion.
So you can take the boy out of Texas, but you can't take Texas out of the boy is what I'm hearing. Or you go back to Texas.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, that's good. So today will maybe make you feel at home, you know, because the biases, but what people may know or may not know, and I'm assuming this is stereotype, but South Padre Island is a resort or even a spring break town. So maybe this is a fun game that we're going to do today that could represent that. So Kyle is actually a very brave individual, and in order to change it up a little bit. So, you know, there are lots of late-breaking clinical trials that are coming out. However, I've distilled down 9 of them that are very much more pharmacotherapy-centric, or that are going to be impacting the pharmacotherapy-centric. So we have 9 trials. And so the first one that we had put in, and what we're going to do is, Kyle doesn't know which 9 of, we're going to probably talk about 3 today, and Kyle doesn't know which 3 he's going to talk about. Now, he's aware of the 9 that I have distilled down to, but he doesn't know what are the 3 that he's going to be talking about. So he's had a little bit of chance to prepare, but this is going to be totally based on a random number generation. So it's kind of like a little bit of a game. And so we're actually going to test Kyle's ability to pivot on this. So this is like a residency test, if you will. But the 9 trials we put in there are, one is the olezarsen in patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia, and that's the core TIMI 72A and the core 2 TIMI B 72 trials, kind of a combined from that standpoint. We're going to put in, and this late breaker has kind of had their top line results shared, but the Vesalius CV trial, the effect of evolocumab in patients at high risk cardiovascular risk without prior myocardial infarction or stroke. The Closure AF trial is number 3. So left atrial appendage closure in patients with atrial fibrillation at high risk or stroke and bleeding compared to medical therapy. The OCEAN trial, which is the need for ongoing oral anticoagulants in patients with clinical stroke risk factors after successful catheter ablation or atrial fibrillation. The DARE-HF trial, which is dabigatran to reduce atrial fibrillation burden after catheter ablation and for atrial fibrillation in patients without diabetes or heart failure. And then kind of combined with that, I've combined these two, is the META-AF, which is metformin as adjunctive therapy to catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation. So number five is really like historically anti-diabetic meds in AFib patients, has a combined 2-for-1. The number six one is the C-sodium to treat, and this is oral potassium supplementation or potassium chloride supplementation safely reduces body sodium surplus and blood pressure in patients with arterial hypertension. Number seven is the CELEBRATE trial, which is a pre-hospital treatment with a new novel glycoprotein B3 inhibitor, zalifrelimab, in patients with ST elevation myocardial infarction undergoing percutaneous coronary intervention. The POLY-HF trial is number eight, so a polypill strategy for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And then the last is the SURPASS-CVOT trial. So that's the once-weekly tirzepatide versus dulaglutide in heart failure outcomes in patients with diabetes or type 2 diabetes. And so, Kyle, we're going to put those numbers into a random number generator and have it pop out the number, the first number. And I tried to get this to have a fun noise that demonstrated that we were actually doing the random number at a time. However, I don't think you can hear it with the audio that we have. So we're going to hit go and see what comes out. And so, Kyle, your first trial that I'm going to ask you about is the, so number eight. So this is the POLY-HF trial. So Kyle, why don't you maybe give us some background of like, why are we even, actually, let's start this. So let's tell me a little bit about the trial, and I can most certainly contribute with you. What is the POLY-HF trial? Like, what is the aim and mission of this study?
Yeah, of course. So POLY-HF, so the polypill strategy for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, really was a proposed study. It's a single center randomized trial to test the feasibility and effectiveness of a polypill based strategy for the treatment of HFrEF, as defined as an EF less than 40% in a low-income population. This study looks like it's being done out of Parkman Hospital in Dallas, Texas, which is a large county hospital that has a very diverse and population, a lot of uninsured population as well. And in HFrEF, we know we have quad therapy with our ACE ARNI, MRAs, SGLT2s, and beta blockers. So what this trial was looking at is to see if using a poly pill with a combination of, I believe they had an SGLT2 inhibitor in there, spironolactone in there, and then a beta blocker at various dosages, depending on what poly pill you got versus standard of care, which is just your normal four individual pillars of GD and T. And I think what they hit on the poly pill here was, like I said, they combined three of the four GD and Ts, but the one that was separate or not included in the poly pill was the renin angiotensin system anticoagulant, so either an ACE, ARB, or ARNI.
Right. And so just to, before we get into like what even are they measuring, let's kind of talk a little bit about this. And you nailed it perfectly. And for those playing at home, we have the link to this study below. And he's absolutely right. They're doing a poly pill, and it's a poly pill strategy. And just to step back from heart failure a minute, this is not a new concept, right, Kyle? We've seen poly pill strategies in hypertension for a long time, and maybe some other disease states. And even not to get into beyond that, they've looked at poly pill for primary prevention, right? That included a antihypertensive, but including, you know, a statin therapy or your aspirin or something, some means of effort. And they've appeared very successful. And the key is we're trying to get at not just adherence, right, but just the inertia. And so, Kyle, just maybe, and people should know, but if they don't know for whatever reason, we're going to make sure everybody's on the same page. What is the challenge we struggle with heart failure patients in terms of you know, why would you say, well, let's do a poly pill? I guess let's ask the question that way. So,
yeah, I think there's multiple answers, I guess, to that question on what are the barriers when it comes to pharmacotherapy for heart failure, whether it be clinical inertia, could be coverages from insurance or expenses type deals. Just as we know from like the CHAMP Heart Failure Registry database and multiple publications out there, is that we do know that quad therapy, I don't think anyone is disagreeing that quad therapy should be on for all heart failure patients, specifically HFrEF patients. But we do see time and time after again that not everyone is, or we're doing a very poor job on optimizing quad therapy for these heart failure patients. And it comes down to these barriers, whether it's taking multiple pills all at one time, like I said earlier, the insurances or cost coverage, clinical inertia. There's many different barriers to it. I think what the polypill concept is we can limit pill burden as being one of the barriers to implementing GDMT. That may see an uptick in adherence, overcoming in clinical inertia, and overcoming just some of the various barriers when it comes to optimizing GDMT for our HFrEF patient population.
Sure. Yeah, so in theory, and let me ask you this question, and I'll tell you my opinion, and we probably agree. If this trial was designed 5 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, do you think they would have... And I don't want to say no one's thought about a poly pill, so I don't want to put it that way. But do you think this trial would have been something that registered with people as being willing to accept a poly pill? Or do you think, in your opinion, do you think because of the change of the way we're thinking about heart failure that this time is right now? What are your thoughts? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
I think so. So let me just reiterate how I understood that. So like, a few years back, would the polypill, I guess, acceptance be as good as it is now in present day, how we're starting to look at polypills for heart failure right now? That's kind of how I understood that question.
Yeah, I guess maybe the way we manage heart failure, do you think, and I was trying to give you ability to talk, but let's put it this way, you know, the now strategy or concept or the more in vogue strategy is to start people on all the pillars at one time, right? And I don't think, you know, remind me again, and not to, to age or when did you finish your training again?
I finished in summer 2023.
Yeah. So realistically, when I started, we did not do all of them at once, right? It was very much you put one and then you do the next one and at different times. I don't think that had you tried to design this several years ago, I'm not saying it wouldn't have worked. I just don't know if people would have thought about it this way, given that, of course, obviously we didn't have SGLT2, so that's a completely different piece of this, right? But just combining things in the way we're managing now, I think that is a, I don't know if the uptake of the concept of a poly pill would have been the same from that standpoint.
I kind of agree with that. And I think even if we go 5-10 years ago, I think a lot of these medications, I mean, ACE and ARBs have been around for a while, so has the MRAs. But I think just the comfortability with initiating 1, 2, 3, or all four at this one time, it does not, the uptake by our healthcare providers, it just all depends on the comfortability with managing these patients. And as heart failure has continued to grow and we have all these medications and we're starting to see a lot more of these four pillars, I think a lot more healthcare providers are becoming at least more comfortable. Their knowledge around these medications and their experience with these medications have uptick that, I don't know that now that I'm trying to say is that I think we can see how this is being accepted as a poly pill for HFrEF, but I don't know 5-10 years ago with this being a relatively new concept with GDMT, quote unquote, how comfortable some of us in the healthcare space would have to do all three at one time. Because back then, like you had mentioned, there was no SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yeah. And obviously, I think in theory, SGLT2 inhibitors, like when you combine SGLT2 inhibitors with spironolactone, in theory, what people state or have seen is that it helps mitigate some of the hyperkalemia of spironolactone. Now, I just want to pause here and mention, so specifically within this polypill, he alluded to it, it's metoprolol succinate, and there's four versions that they did in this study. The versions are based on the metoprolol succinate dose. So if you're thinking about titrating, it's 25, 50, 100, and 150 milligram versions of the pill with metoprolol succinate in them. But then the standard flat dosing for the other two is empagliflozin 10 milligrams, which is pretty standard. But then I kind of want to hear your opinion about this. The standard dose for the spironolactone is 12.5 milligrams. So from a historical perspective, if you think about Rawls and emphasis in the other studies, what are your thoughts about that spironolactone 12.5 versus what we normally see potentially?
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting choice. I'm not sure why. Well, I have a theory, I guess, or my own opinion on why they may have done 12.5 our lowest dose, and maybe just to kind of mitigate any potential adverse effects, maybe just lower incidence of hyperkalemia, lower blood pressure fluctuations. But we do have data out there published in JACC in 2020. I forgot who the authors of this study. It's one of my most cited papers on Rounds when it comes to MRAs and blood pressure lowering effects, is that the blood pressure lowering effects, which specifically in our high prep population with the MRA, so it's not as significant as like it may be thought about in like the general like primary hypertension population. So it's just interesting to me that the 12.5 was chosen and not 25. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not really aware, or I don't know if it's, yes, we have target doses from emphasis on Rails trial, but I'm not really sure, like, if clinically 12.5 of spironolactone versus 25 milligrams of spironolactone would make any clinically significant difference, like at heart for.
Well, the reason I bring that is the vast majority of patients ended up being on 25 milligrams in those two studies. So I think that's where, you know, when you look at if you're adherent to what the trials say, that's what the dose was, right? And so that's, you would argue to see, okay, what are the impacts? But to your point, I do think it involves maybe concern or balancing out the safety. And it's not that 12.5, to your point, wouldn't work from that standpoint. But you did have some people that got up to the 50 in that particular study. What's interesting, and you can argumentally put this in another vein, and I won't go on a complete side tangent around finerenone, but you know, in their trial, they definitely did do a more aggressiveness in terms of titration. And granted, that was a PEF study, but they are doing a reduced EF study about really trying to get people up titrated. Whereas generally, when I think about practicing, or a lot of people, they do just a standard 25 milligram dose of spironolactone and kind of go that way, or decrease it if there's other reasons from that standpoint. So it's just, it's not wrong. It's not that I'm saying the trial or the tablet's wrong. It's just an interesting choice from that standpoint. And so just, you know, the people they enrolled in this trial, just so people are aware, they're greater than age of 18, heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, so 40% or less. They're class 2 through 4 symptoms. Definitely not on guideline-directed therapy at the time. So what that means is no one was on 100% target dose beta blocker or spironolactone or eplerenone or empagliflozin or any RAS at the time. So really, this is like a kind of a new population, right? And then obviously, they couldn't have anything that would contraindicate you for these therapies like potassium of 5 or anything to that effect. But then they recruited them from this safety net hospital. And we'll talk a little bit about the baseline characteristics, because that kind of indicates this group from that same point. But what were their primary, what's the primary outcome of the study, Kyle?
Yeah, so the primary outcome was left ventricular ejection fraction at 6 months, just from baseline. It was assessed by cardiac MRI. And then the secondary endpoints was a hierarchical composite win ratio based endpoint and changes in quality of life adherence assessed by therapeutic drug monitoring. And then they also looked at NT-proBNP as an additional secondary outcome as well.
Yeah, so this is really a phase 2 type study, right?
Correct.
It's not, a phase 3 study. Obviously, this product doesn't necessarily exist at the current moment. I think this is an FDA investigation of new drug, and they've kind of compounded this product. And so kind of see, and how many patients did they look to randomize into this? And to your point, yes, they're looking at CMR, they're looking at changes, which is good, because, you know, a lot of times when we have studies like this, we're looking at CMR changes or MRI, you know, changes of your LVF to look at, are you seeing improving the ejection fraction? And we won't get into the you know, echo versus CMR based conversation of what is more appropriate or the gold standard, but so, you know, kind of to your point, how many patients did they kind of enroll overall in the study, or at least?
They had around a little over 200. I think it was like 212 patients, and it was split evenly in a 1-to-1. So I think it was like 108 on the poly pill and 104 in the usual care group is how they ended up finalizing that.
Yeah, so 100 in the chronic or 112 in a new set. Yeah, you're right, poly pill. And actually, the age range, what they say, you know, you average about 54, age of 54. They actually did a pretty decent job, relatively speaking. You know, always could do better. About 22% are female. A lot of what was I thought was amazing, and I don't know, you know, a lot of Black or African American patients, you know, only about 45% white. And of course, being in Texas, they had Hispanic ethnicity. So a really diverse group of patient population, which I think is great, given that we often do not see that in a lot of heart failure trials, given that they're done globally or internationally to that standpoint.
Yeah. And one other point about the baseline characteristics that I thought was interesting too is like, what they reported was that like 68% were uninsured or relying on like some county indigenous health programs,
right.
Which is very interesting, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners and you are aware, when it comes to getting these GDMT medications covered, that can be a kind of a hassle, a barrier, if, depending on what are the patient's insurance plans and if they're uninsured, insured, what plan they have, Medicare, Medicaid, and yada yada yada. So I think that was a very interesting thing. And as we know, just from like the other poly pills that are out there with other cardiovascular diseases, poly pills generally are typically more expensive than just using a regular single generic pill. So that was a very interesting thing to me.
Well, clearly, because what will happen is, you know, if this were to get approved and uptake, I'm sure it would be a name brand based product, which would have cost to it. But yeah, you're up to it. What I do appreciate this is it really does look at the social determinants and tries to understand, you know, has a piece to this, because you alluded to it. Adherence is a part of the process. You know, are we going to help impact some of these social determinants and look at it across the process from that standpoint? So it really is getting at not just, oh, can we remove inertia from the standpoint of the clinician or other folks, but does it actually improve adherence? Do the people, are they more engaged with it? And then of course, obviously we have to look at outcomes. Now, in theory though, we should have outcomes the outcomes should work, because we know these therapy works, work from that standpoint. So, you know, then it's a simplified regimen, that standpoint. So it doesn't mean, you know, people don't have to think about, are they getting them all? You know, the one implementation barrier I could see is like, okay, are people going to start all these therapies at the same time? We'll see what happens from that standpoint. But anything else on that study?
No, but I guess one other thing that was interesting to me, and I don't think this would be found out through this trial, but it's like, with this poly pill, I thought it was interesting how they chose the metoprolol, the empagliflozin, and spironolactone. But let's say we start this poly pill on our heart failure patient and you put them on an ARNI, but then how does it look like when it comes to up titrating in the future? Once, like, let's say this gets rolled out, but you start them on this, a month later, they come back to your heart failure clinic, and looking at managing this poly pill when it comes to up titration to the beta blocker target dose, or
right,
if they get admitted for volume overload because it was Thanksgiving's around the corner and they just had too much salt on their diet, how does that look like for drive or heart failure pharmacotherapy management in the future if this gets approved? So those are just some of those things that are on the back of my mind. Curious of how hard for you to manage.
There's a different type of implementation issue, right? It's like, it's one thing getting them on, but what do you do when you're mitigating through this?
And yeah.
So very good.
Not bad. Yeah, that's all I had for the PolyHF trial.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold you back to it when we get the results for these things. Okay. So we're going to go into the random number generator. So we're going to click in. I'm pulling out number. That was number 8. So I'm pulling number 8 out. And I'm going to redo the random number generator. And I'm going to hit submit. And so, Kyle, the next one, the suspense is killing everyone, that we're going to talk about is, this is the Celebrate study. All right. So let's tell us what we're going to be celebrating. Tell me a little bit about the study and why is this kind of going to be interesting or impactful?
Yeah. So Celebrate trial, full title is a pre-hospital treatment with, forgive me if I mispronounce this name, but Zalanfibin in patients with STEMI undergoing primary PCI. And basically, this trial is a phase 3 randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled international trial conducted in Europe, North America, and kind of like alluded to in the trial, these are patients with STEMI presenting with persistent ischemic chest pain, and whom the total duration of symptoms is like 4 hours maximum. They're getting randomized to this GP2B3A platelet inhibitor called Zalanfibin, which is a sub-Q auto-injector that's supposed to be administered in the early onset of STEMI initiation, and it's supposed to be administered by the ambulances en route to a PCI capable facility hospital.
Yes. And so let's pause there for a minute. And you're absolutely correct on this. And so just, did you get to kind of look at this agent and how it's a little bit different than other glycoprotein 2B3 inhibitors? And let me add this question. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead. No. Yep.
Oh, no, you can ask the other question too.
No, my other question is just like, you know, obviously, you know, there was a time, and I don't know, you know, there was a time even kind of early in my career where we were still using a decent amount of glycoprotein 2B3 inhibitors. I don't know what your current practice is at your facility and how they're being used, but not very often. You know, and I think part of that is, you know, some of the risk of bleeding and the side effects. Of course, we had better oral antiplatelets from that standpoint. And I'll talk about that in contact in a minute. But what makes this one a little bit different than the ones that are in existence today? And, you know, realistically, the ones that we only have now, because they've taken ebsixamab off of the market. And that was one, but now we have tirofibin and eptifibatide. So what is the kind of difference compared to this one and what is in existence today?
Yeah, I think the main difference is like the PK/PD profile of this. So it is a sub-Q auto-injector. It comes back in like a 1 ml injection. But the really cool thing I thought was like the onset or the max effect you get achieved within 15 minutes. And it only really lasts for about 1 to 2 hours that was reported on the PK studies. So it is a mg per kg dosing, and I think unlike our other IV GP2B3A inhibitors, this is a little bit shorter acting on the PK/PD trials for these agents, show less thrombocytopenia, less just overall adverse events that we typically see with our other GP2B3A agents.
Now, Kyle, you probably are aware of this from your training or have talked about this, but this is not the first time we've given a antiplatelet in an ambulance-based setting. Is that correct? Of course, outside of aspirin. I know we do aspirin now, but just in terms of beyond aspirin, what is your knowledge of this?
Oh, just like, I guess kind of how like preloading or extra-loading.
Preloading. We'll talk about preloading, but yes, clearly in the United States, we do not do EMS based. It's a little bit different domain than in Europe. So one thing that's going to be interesting about this, and we already know the top line results from the study, not the specific results, but we know it met its primary endpoint.
Right.
And we'll get into that in a minute, but it's like, how do you make this work in the United States healthcare system with the way, you know, EMS is different everywhere, whether it's county owned or hospital owned or what that process is. But realistically, and this is not the only agent that's coming out currently that is doing this process. There is actually a P2Y12 inhibitor called selatogrel that is being investigated as a subcutaneous agent that people administer at home when they have onset of chest pain that's short acting. And of course, you said this is a subcutaneous one. Now, it works very much quicker, like you said, compared to our other glycoprotein 2B3 inhibitors, but it, you know, resembles maybe a profile of a Kangalore to some extent, right? But Kangalore has not been put in an auto injector, right? It's not helpful.
Correct.
But we, to your point, we've had preload settings. So what is, do you know the preload study they did with ticagrelor?
I am blanking on the name.
The Atlantic study. So they essentially did the very same concept. And it actually showed what you would suspect, a reduction in stent thrombosis and your adverse cardiac events, you know, when you give ticagrelor in an ambulance from that standpoint. Now, you know, it didn't, you know, improve coronary perfusion, but the benefit, again, that they ended up seeing is kind of the stent thrombosis piece, which is, you know, realistically what you may hope that it was reduced. It will be interesting to see in this study. So why don't you tell us, Kyle, what is the kind of dose and outcomes that they're looking for this study?
Yeah, so outcomes-wise, what they were, let me start with the dose. So this trial was done in a 1:1:1 randomization. So the first dose was 0.110 mg per kg. Another dose was 0.130 mg per kg. And then your other arm was just placebo administration. And the primary outcomes of this study was basically a safety objective, just as bleeding events. They were using the GUSTO criteria for the safety outcomes. And then from the clinical outcomes at 30 days in patients with STEMI, they were looking at a ranked 7-point scale compared to placebo. And within that ranked 7-point scale, they looked at all-cause death through 30 days, hemorrhagic or ischemic stroke through 30 days, recurrent MIs type 1 to type 4 through 30 days, acute stent thrombosis at 24 hours post-PCI, new onset heart failure or rehospitalization for heart failure through 30 days, MI with high sensitive cardiac troponin levels greater than 10 times the upper limit of normal at 24 hours post-PCI, or none of the above. So those were the 7-point scale of clinical outcomes at 30 days as their primary efficacy outcome.
Right. And like you said, we already know based on kind of the press release that the company making this Celicor, for who did the Celebrate study, you know, it met its primary endpoint of the ranked 7-point scale at 30 days that you were talking about. That includes all-cause mortality, stroke, recurrent MI, acute stent thrombosis, new onset heart failure, rehospitalization, and the high sensitivity. So it'll be interesting to see what of those are changed, you know, because that's a pretty large composite endpoint. And then, you know, obviously what the safety of this is going to look like from that standpoint. But it'll be interesting to see, because we've had other trials that have looked at this, and again, with Atlantic, it was stent thrombosis with the ticagrelor very upfront before PCI. I think the beauty of this is, like all these agents, the earlier the better. And if you need it to end up going to surgery or something else, you're able to wash them out very, very quickly from that standpoint. It is crazy to you, Kyle, I don't know what your thoughts are, that we are still asking these questions, right? Given that, you know, like, it's like we're still asking, what is the early, early is better. And I think that's something to said about, like, we still want to optimize patients as early as possible, but it'll be interesting to see, and this is just my take on this, I'd love to hear your thought. I'm not sure what additional bang for buck that we're going to get, because I think we do a pretty great job managing people. I think the biggest thing we need to do is not necessarily just antiplatelet, but really getting people to identify that they have chest pain earlier and getting to the hospital versus it being a full antiplatelet thing. But it'll, you know, I can't wait to see what the results are. What are your thoughts, or what are your thinkings of this type of data or trial?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, it was interesting on the press release that they said it did meet that 7-point. Just for the listeners, like, everyone else was on the standard of care was like aspirin, heparin, and they left the oral P2Y12 loading doses are left up to the trial investigator or the managing physician. So I'm not really sure, kind of to your point, like what this is going to provide. And even let's say this trial and the results when they get released, it just a home run, knocks it out of the park. It goes back to like your earlier point, Greg. I don't know how in the U.S., how we can optimally roll this out with EMS varying from just even from like in the state level or county level. There's just so much variability with how EMS is run, with their contract through the hospitals, which hospitals they go to. It just seems like it's a very big, almost.
Well, and is it EMS kind of pay the cost for the drug, right? Like, how is that going to work? But I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, to your point, it'll be interesting to see the devil in the details of how other people, the placebo group was treated or managed or loaded. You know, what does that look like? You know, I'm definitely interested about the ranked outcomes of the study to see what that looks like. Now, again, they're not going to be alone because there are other agents that are looking at this very type of question, like I said, with selatogrel, and they're actually, it's a different version. This is where the patient would have this in their house and they would self-administer, which is interesting to me with selatogrel, but it definitely, you know, is going to be interesting to see. And of course, they have a lot of pre-specified subgroups and others that could be helpful to figure out. But it is so fascinating to see that we are still trying to figure out what STEMI patients, how can we get that preloading in and have different agents from that standpoint. And of course, we'll see what the Gusto bleeding says. It's, you know, Gusto's pretty common bleeding tool. I mean, a lot of other studies have used kind of TEMI-based bleeding or other strategies, but what we will see,
sure.
Gusto's pretty common. All right, let's switch over back to the number generator, Kyle. Last one. Let's see here. We've taken out 8. We're taking out 7. We're going to hit the number generator now. And the number is 2, which is, let me go to the list. 2 is the Vesalius CV, effect of evilocumab in patients with high coronary vascular risk and without history of primary Meyer stroke. Another study that has had a press release earlier this year. So why don't you jump in and tell me about this study, or at least what they're looking at?
Yeah, the Vesalius CV. So basically was to evaluate the effect of evilocumab on the risk of major cardiovascular events in patients deemed in high cardiovascular risk, but without any prior ischemic events. This study had around 12,000 patients with atherosclerosis or high-risk diabetes without a prior MIR stroke. I believe they had to have an LDL of greater than 90 or non-HDL lipoprotein cholesterol greater than 120 or an apolipoprotein B greater than 80. And you were on optimized lipid-lowering therapy. Patients were randomized in a 1-to-1 ratio to either evolucumab 140 milligrams subcutaneous every 2 weeks or matching placebo. And the primary efficacy objective was to assess whether evolucumab reduced the risk of the dual primary composite endpoints of coronary heart disease death, myocardial infarction or ischemic stroke, and of CHD death, MI ischemic stroke, or ischemia-driven arterial revascularization, which was like a quadruple primary endpoint as well.
Yep. And so when you think about this, do you classify, just for people to put it in other terms, do you classify this as a primary or secondary prevention study?
A primary prevention study.
This is for sure a primary prevention study, which is different because, like you said, we have Fourier, which looked at patients, you know, post or, you know, kind of in that secondary phase and that demonstrated a benefit to this study. And so kind of walk through the trial design of the study. I know you talked about the risk population. So when, you know, what did they get? How often did they get it? What was the follow-up?
So in terms of like how often they got the medication?
Yeah, what was the dosing schedule? And then, you know, they followed them up how often after they did the medication, how often did they follow them after that point?
Oh, yeah. So the dosing schedule was 140 milligrams every 2 weeks versus your placebo, like they give you a placebo subcutaneous every 2 weeks. And then follow-up was Q4 months, I believe, and the median duration of trial was about 4.5 years.
Yep. And they looked at, you know, all the traditional things that you looked at in terms of you know, the outcomes with LDL, but also looking at really major adverse cardiac events, you know, that they're looking at in terms of that outcome. And, you know, they really tried to pick relatively high risk patients that would be at risk for an event. So it is still primary prevention, but to me, I don't know what you classify. I still, they are high risk, higher risk for having an event, but they're primary prevention based patients.
Yeah, I agree with that statement 100%.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, what's interesting, and just as an aside from this, Kyle, you know, I think, I don't know if you're aware, you may be aware that there are other people looking at, you know, oral PCSK9 inhibitors, right? There's, for example, several in development at this particular juncture. And I think the shifting kind of domains, and you saw that, I don't know if, did you look at the updated hyperlipidemia guidelines at the European Society of Cardiology this past year that they really, or this, you know, they released a couple months ago. Did you get to look at them?
Not in depth, just like breeze through them. So we'll make our way through them.
No, I think, you know, it's interesting. And of course, you know, they're in the process of rewriting our guidelines. And it's going to be interesting because this trial will be published in the confines or the process of writing the hyperlipidemia guidelines. So it's going to be interesting to see. But, you know, I think people are really leaning into or changing over that it's not just, oh, you know, from a secondary prevention standpoint, it really is about that cumulative exposure of LDL and how people having exposure beyond. And this is kind of a wave of that, you know, as a primary prevention. It's not just, oh, you've had an event and your LDL is high. It's not just that you have a high LDL and your risk. It's like, what does that look like? And even with the orals, they're talking about, you know, kind of that, I don't want to stage it, but like an early stage patient, like, you know, early on before they start gathering risk factors or contracting a variety of different risk factors. Is it more about the cumulative exposure, not just the number you see as you collect the lab value? So, Kyle, one thing I wanted to ask you about this kind of process is kind of where would you see, depending, you know, we know it met its primary endpoint. We don't know what it looks like, what that number looks like, what it means. What do you think, where would you, and of course I had to be on statin therapy, right? You mentioned that, correct?
Yep.
Where do you think you would see this? How do you see this being in play after it comes out? Like, what are you going to think? How are you thinking about, would think about this differently from a primary prevention standpoint?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And one interesting thing I think that caught my eye from this study design is when, like, their inclusion criteria, yes, like, you have to have an LDL greater than 90 or a non-HDLC greater than 120, but the one thing that caught my eye was an apolipoprotein B or ApoB greater than 80, which that to me was a little interesting because, like, if you look at the 2022 ASBC statements, like, because they're elevated ApoB greater than 130, and most like cardiovascular statements or guidelines out there, when they, in the context of ApoB, they used that 130 cutoff as, like, an elevated ApoB. They use in this trials an ApoB greater than 80. So I'm really interested to see what the mean ApoB is of this trial, because a lot of my research right now in practice is with ApoB, and I think ApoB is a great metric for primary prevention in the cardiovascular disease state, because as we all know, like, there's more to this LDL out there, and ApoB, there's one ApoB per whether it's a chylomicron, VLDL, IDL, LDL, LPL, there's an ApoB per particle on those particles. And I think it gives a better bird's eye view of our atherogenic risk. So to back to your question, I think depending on what this study shows in our primary prevention, those that are high risk, like, yes, you may have a normal-ish, quote unquote, LDL on statin, but if you have an elevated ApoB, whether it's greater than 80 or up into that 130 mark, I think this evolucumab in the primary prevention role is a signal that, hey, if you have this patient hasn't had an event yet, but their ApoB is still elevated on top of optimally treated statins, that, hey, maybe we need to get this person on evolucumab to prevent any type of CBD in the future. So that's kind of like what I'm thinking with or thinking about sure. this trial.
So pause for me here. Tell me what type of work are you doing with APOB, since you said you're that's your primary research for this?
Yeah. So one of our positions here where I work, her name is Dr. Priyanka Sethi. She's our director of our cardiac prevention center. We're just looking at APOB in the, her cardiac prevention clinic and seeing if it correlates or doesn't correlate with an LDL, trying to identify these patients that are at high risk, but may not look as high risk on just a standard lipid profile, and looking at kind of just optimizing lipid lowering therapy agents for these quote unquote high risk primary prevention patients. We do have a couple APOB review articles that hopefully will get published here in maybe before end of 2025 or late 2026 at the moment. But
so are you guys routinely checking APOB on people?
If
or just in the context of studies?
I would say a little bit of both. I think we're trying to get APOB checked a little bit more frequently and more often, just because it's not a super expensive lab test. It gives us a little bit more better bird's eye view of their atherogenic risk. And also for those that, whether it's in the primary or secondary prevention space, that we can use this APOB lab marker to kind of quantify our risk stratify in a little bit more optimal way. So that's kind of how we're trying to push the needle forward in this primary prevention space with APOB.
And so let me ask you one more question, then I have another question. Are you also routinely checking Lp(a)?
Yes. And I mean, as you know, Lp(a) is the hot topic right now within right. primary prevention space. The only thing is, I feel like I understand Lp(a). I just don't really know really what to do with it at the moment. So as we know, really
good.
We'll check both for like a short answer, but the Lp(a), I mean, as you know, I mean, there is studies out there developing drugs to lower Lp(a), but we don't have anything in our toolbox that can directly lower Lp(a) at this point in time. So yes, an elevated Lp(a) tells us that you're at some degree of risk of having a cardiovascular event, but I don't really know what to do with that at this moment. So whereas we have APOB, if it's elevated, you know you have an increased risk of a cardiovascular event, but we do have tools in our toolbox that we can drive APOB down and lower your cardiovascular risk. So that's, me personally, I prefer checking the APOB over an Lp(a), but for the grand scheme of things, we'll usually check both as well.
Sure. And so what are you doing when your APOB comes back? Or like your patient, or your what, just for people who may or may not know, what are your strategies, or what are you guys doing when you have, you know, if someone comes back with their currently under today's strategy, what are you doing if people looked like this in the clinical trial? Does that make sense? Do you get what I'm asking?
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously, like, first step, like, everyone's already optimized. Let's make it simple. Everyone's already optimized either on the maximally tolerated statin. If their APOB comes back elevated, whether that's be greater than 130, some preventive cardiologists have different, thresholds for what they consider elevated, but I'm just going to use what the American Society of Preventive Cardiology states as elevated as 130 just for the sake of this podcast. But let's say it's greater than 130 then, and you're already on optimally tolerated statin therapy, well, then that's a signal for us to, like, hey, let's put on our next step, which is ezetimibe. And if that doesn't get you down or get the APOB to our goal, then we start looking at these PCSK9 inhibitors to kind of, to drive down APOB even further and to limit the, I guess, ASCVD risk that this patient may be at.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you for sharing. Kyle, this has been fun and great. Hopefully this wasn't too nerve-wracking for you.
No, this is fun.
Kyle, thank you for taking the time for being here. Let me ask you some non-clinical questions. We ask all of our guests here, what's one thing you're reading or watching or, you know, kind of into right now?
Well, I'm a big sports fan. Like, that's what probably my primarily my hobby is, and it is the fall. I'm a big football fan. I went to the University of Texas Austin for undergrad, so right now most of my Saturdays are filled with going to UT football games. I was just at the University of Texas versus Vanderbilt football game yesterday, and we won 4-31. So that takes up pretty much all my fall right now. So it's just big sports, and then right after this podcast, I'll probably watch the remaining of the Chiefs and Bills NFL game that's going on. So I'm a big football sports guy, and I think all my friends can attest to that as well.
Very good. Kyle, if people wanted to find you, do you have a faculty page or social media, or, you know, what are you be interested to share?
Yeah, my, I guess, formerly Twitter, now X, it's at K Fisher. My last name is FISCHER_10. Usually posts every now and then regarding the cardiovascular topics or just cardiology topics in general. That's where you probably can most easily find me. It's on my X page at KFisher_10.
All right, perfect. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. We're going to probably follow up with you after the meeting to see what has come of these trials. And again, for the listeners, we will do the other trials as well. We just kind of did this in a different format, but this is to kind of whet your appetite and get excited about it, totally done randomly. But we will follow up after the trial and look for us to do some, hopefully, activities there on site or afterwards. And like I said, if you have comments or feedback or interest in making this podcast better, please let us know. You can reach out to me. You can reach out to the podcast specifically either on social media or email me or via my faculty page. You most certainly hit like, subscribe, please rank or rate us. And with that, Kyle, thank you again. And I wish everybody the best. And we'll see you at AHA.
Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you.